Accession number 10182, Reel 1.
Mr. Franklin, Reel 1, could you tell me where you were stationed and what job you were doing when the Battle of Britain broke out in 1914?
I was a sector controller at Biggin Hill.
Can you tell me what a sector controller is and what he does?
A sector controller, of which I think there were four of us, took it in rotation to be on duty to take the orders from 11 Group and pass them on to the squadrons to do what 11 Group had in mind.
Can you tell me the character of the type of orders one would get from 11 Group, typically?
They were, generally speaking, the amount of aircraft they want involved, be it a flight or be it a squadron, and prior to the Battle of Britain to go on patrol, maybe over Maidstone or somewhere in the south at the height, according to what they heard at Group, whether they sent them to 10,000 feet or 20,000 feet.
And how would you then liaise with the people to whom you would instruct?
Oh, over the RT.
How did it work?
Well, it worked in a way. Of course, there was no VHF at the start of the Battle of Britain, and we had the old, I forget what it was called now, HT or something, which was a very comparatively primitive form of air-to-ground radio. I mean, the advent is like the early days of broadcasting to what we have today. And it was pretty primitive and rather difficult at times to control. I'm talking of the older radio, the HT.
In what way difficult to control?
Bad reception. Difficult reception, I would say, compared to the clarity which came when VHF came in, which I think came in towards the latter end of the Battle of Britain, I would have thought.
Was there anything you could do about the bad reception, or did you just have to grin and bear it?
You had to grin and bear it. You had your signals officer trying to do what he could.
Whereabouts would you be located in the airbase doing your job?
Well, not for me to criticise going by, but of course we were on the aerodrome, which turned out to be not a very good place to be.
Because of noise or attacks? Or
well, we eventually got bombed out.
Can you describe the layout of Biggin Hill?
Bit difficult to do now, but I mean the operations room was comparatively close to the officers' mess on the perimeter, with the road running through, a public road running through, as far as I can remember.
Which particular squadrons were based at Biggin Hill at the time?
Oh, you got me there, because through the Battle of Britain they changed, but they're all on record somewhere. I'm afraid, if I hazarded a guess, I'd probably tell you the wrong ones.
What kind of hours would you be working during the Battle of Britain?
I suppose one was probably either four hours on and 4 hours off, maybe, something like that. We were never there for very long. The Battle of Britain, it is rather hard to say, because I should be able to recollect, because I was controlling when the first raid came over. And it was certainly, should I say, a slight surprise. I mean, the quantity. And that, you see, that the raid itself, I mean, would probably have lasted, what, an hour and a half. So it means 2.5 hours, 3 hours, hard at it, probably, I suppose.
So this was a sudden attack on Biggin Hill by the Luftwaffe?
No. This was the general start of the attack, not necessarily on Biggin Hill, because the attack on the aerodromes came comparatively late in the BFB.
Can you describe that first attack?
I think one of enormous surprise, because we were dealing with a quantity of aircraft, which, I mean, was quite staggering as far as I think we were all concerned. When you were thinking in terms of putting, I suppose, what, 20 aircraft against 200, put it that way.
What kind of aircraft were based at Biggin Hill?
Hurricanes, primarily, and then the early Spitfires.
What was the morale of the men at the aerodrome like?
Oh, quite marvellous. A great bunch.
Did you have any sense that history was being made?
Not even faintly.
Did you feel that the fate of the country was at stake? That we would be invaded if the Battle of Britain wasn't won?
Certainly a very good question. It's rather hard to say. I was an old man at 30 then, and most of the chaps you're dealing with for 20 and less, if you see what I mean. They were young men, and even at my age, I got on with my job, and it was all mixed up with the squadrons who've gone to France and come back. You were involved in your own aspect of the war, and I would go so far as to say you were interested as far as your own group went, to see what I mean, 11 group.
What kind of decisions did you have to make once you got the instructions from 11 Group?
To try and, in that type of control, to try and position the formation which you had under your control in the right position from vis-à-vis the sun or any conditions, so that when they saw the enemy, so to speak, that they were in a good position to attack, or in a favourable position for them to take control of themselves to attack. And we could only put them where we thought the best position was. When they'd sighted what was the opposition, it was then naturally up to the squadron commander or flag commander to deal with the situation as he saw it. We could only put them into what we considered the best position.
What general tactics did you adopt?
Well, of course, they were rather homemade, because it hadn't happened before. I couldn't say. I think, put it this way, that nearly all of us were pilots ourselves. So I think one probably had a feeling of what went on in the air. I mean, it wasn't a cool, calm, calculating job. You worked off a plot at a big table in those days, plot of... which was coming from the radar stations, and I think one did it by second sense or whatever it is. I suppose it just became a quite natural situation, I think, to be able to transfer what you saw on a map into what it was in the air. I mean, point of fact, other than being shot at, so to speak, I mean, I think you could.
What did the table plot look like?
Of course, there are many, many pictures there. I haven't got any to show. It was a great big plot of your area, roughly the 11 Group area, the south of England and this and that, which was fed in the plots which came onto the table, came in from the radar stations, which, as I think you probably know, were very nearly complete when the war started. the CH station, CHL, which went to a room up at Fighter Command, the filter room, where they would assess the mean course from the plots received from the stations. And that mean course, or plot, would come on to you. So I had, or the controller had, in front of him, the best that filtered radar could give you in direction, and in those days, not very brilliant on height, because it was rather later to a degree that radar was fine looking at it, but it could, looking at the plot, but it wasn't very good at assessing, necessarily assessing height.
Did you have to make split-second decisions, or did you have plenty of time?
Oh, I think, I can't say one had plenty of time always. No, I'm sure one did make a lot of split-second ones. But once your battle is joined, so to speak, a lot of your other attentions would come to do with aircraft shot up, coming back, or incidents, air sea rescue, 1,001 other things. So you weren't merely controlling aircraft, and you were thinking in terms of aircraft landing back, or squadrons, or flights landing back to rearm and refuel to go up again. It was pretty busy time.
What were the main problems that you had during the Battle of Britain, would you say, apart from the inadequate reception?
Shortage of aircraft, I think. I mean, comparatively. Yeah, I mean, the some of it, in my memory, very early on, sadly, the chap I'm thinking of is now dead, but, I mean, he had, I think in those days, I think it was 12 aircraft, and I'm absolutely sure that what I was doing to him was putting into about 100 against. But, as you know, that was a feature of the Battle of Britain, and it was our type of training, and of course, marvellous squadron training, and the luck of the wise men who got radar going, and the start of interception was done at Biggin, funnily enough, 2 or 3 years before the war. That was where it first started. All the gubbins which go to build up large sector control.
Who was your immediate boss at Biggin Hill?
My immediate boss, I suppose, was Dick Grice, who was a group captain, who was station commander. Funnily enough, I couldn't tell you who was the senior controller, because I was hauled in, I only got there just before the BOB. I'd been working, which, see on my thing I've given you, with a fellow called Walter Pretty, which was the start of low-level interception, which was an entirely different thing, which developed later in the war. But I was hauled out of that and whistled up to Biggin as a sector controller. And very shortly after arrival, I found myself sector controller. I hadn't been taught anything.
In what way did Grice exercise his command?
He didn't exercise command over what any sector controller was doing. But he would talk to group and advise or this or that. But, I mean, from point of view of actually taking over control, I don't think I ever saw him do it.
What kind of staff were you relying on under you?
Marvellous WAFs. And, of course, a very good lot of regular signals officers. I say signals officers. A very fine lot there, of old Air Force, warrant officers, etc.
You said that the station got attacked. Can you describe that particular attack and what happened as far as you observed it?
Well, I can indeed, because I think they attacked us and Kenley and North Weald all the same time. And I think I'm right in saying that we didn't know at the time we were going to be attacked. And actually the lot that hit us came in pretty well unattacked at a lower level than certainly we thought. From a direction I think we didn't fancy. And they made pretty good hay on the airfield and destroyed nearly every hangar, I think I'm right in saying. And then one lobbed into the ops room just behind me, which of course put paid to any form of control as far as that particular ops room was concerned. Casualties were simply incredible because we didn't, I think there were maybe one or maybe two killed, but no more than that.
Why do you think there were so few killed?
It fell well behind me and out, how do I remember, it hit the end of one of the, against the outbuildings of the ops room, enough to demolish practically everything in the ops room and everything went out. But nobody in point of fact in the operation room itself was killed. I remember that.
Can you describe the damage to the operations room?
It's really rather hard to say. I mean, it was full of dust and debris and it wasn't a very substantial building as far as I can remember. You know what I mean? It was, I would think largely wood as opposed to brick. In fact, I'm sure it was.
When approximately did the attack occur?
I'm afraid my memory can't tell you that. If I'd thought of anything, I suppose I'd think in mid-afternoon, but I could be wrong, I'm afraid.
And it was in August, was it?
Again, I mentioned August.
What did you think to the tactics which the Luftwaffe employed in the Battle of Britain?
Well, I would have thought, as a layman, I wasn't a layman then, but it was very surprising. I mean, to the extent that I remember once, without mentioning names, although he's dead, a marvellous decision made by the group controller, and a great wave of aircraft came over and we did absolutely nothing about it because it was entirely a German fighter sweep, which there was no point in us getting involved in. So tactically, it's hard to say. That would be a B time. I suppose one was really struggling largely to have a sufficient aircraft from day to day, put it that way. I mean, that would be, I suppose, one's memory of squadron strength going down and down until you found yourself in a position with extraordinarily few aircraft to deal with still quite a big problem.
What about the degree of training of the pilots, the British pilots who were sent up?
Oh, of course, that varied terribly I wouldn't really be the person to say that, but my own guess would be that in the early stages, of course, you had the more mature pilots, and in the end, of course, you were calling in a lot of barely trained pilots. I mean, the start of the war, without mentioning names, people a great deal of flying experience and I'm going to say true RAF as opposed to the younger, I'm going to say conscripts, I don't mean that, the younger volunteers coming in. I wouldn't say anything against them, but I mean I should have thought that the start of it we They were more in a position. They'd been flying as a squadron or training as a squadron together and under comparatively peaceful conditions. I mean, even when, you know, during the period from the start of the war in 39, when really nothing was happening particularly, you know, over here. So you had better trained squadrons, I should have thought.
Did you not have much direct contact with the pilots?
Oh, yes. Did indeed. Yeah. A lot of them were my own personal friends. See, I was an auxiliary airman, which you'll see on mine. I had started my flying in about 1931 in the 600 squadron. And then I was on the reserve when the war came. And then I went with my squadron to war station and then down to... Well, you'll see it all in my curriculum. And I got mixed up with the control thing through my commanding officer, who was subsequently killed, who was a marvellous chap, and put me in touch, or rather with Bordsey. If you look up Bordsey, you'll find Bordsey was the start of radar controlled interception. And my chap, who was in charge of flight operations, was Walter Pretty, who eventually became chief signals officer, whatever he was. Ended as an AVM. Died about 10 years ago, I suppose.
Who were your other particular friends at Biggin Hill?
Very hard to say. You see, I mean, pilots, I suppose... A lot of the regular staff, you know, the regular officers who I met there, I suppose, in the main. My station commander was a very... Dick Grice, I was very fond of him. But it was a busy life.
Did the Battle of Britain take its toll on you much in terms of tiredness as the battle went on?
Did it take... Well, you see, it's rather hard to say. I mean, after we were bombed, we had to move into other quarters, which was a butcher's shop in the village, which was rather strange. Now, I think it was so all-absorbing, really, because, you see, you had one side, and in my memory, you had one side of the Battle of Britain, which slowly changed into the night battle. You see, which became, of course, a much larger part in one's life. In fact, when the Battle of Britain was over, then we had to scratch our heads when we simply, quite frankly, didn't have the wherewithal to deal with the night raids, which were, from one's own angle, I suppose, as absorbing, if that is the right word, as the Battle of Britain, and the advance of different types of control, which is the type of control which I was in when the war started, funnily enough.
What was it like working at the butcher shop?
Slightly original. Minuscule control. I mean, rarely, it was only a landline. I mean, you could talk to the squadrons. You had from the point of view of having radar plots, you'd get some from one station, because I always feel a slightly unsung bit of the B&B was the work done by post office engineers, because we had largely were landline communications. You can imagine in that part of the world, bombs whistling down. I mean, right the way through the day, 24 hours in the day, were post office engineers were out mending landlines to get the information through to sectors. Marvellous job. Marvellous job.
Can you tell me any particular incidents which stick out in your mind during the Battle of Britain, apart from the attack on the airfield?
Now, I think it'd be very hard to pick out. Again, one's memory is at fault, and I wouldn't like to do it, but I mean, there were a lot of very, very notable figures there. Right early on, I suppose, the great Sailor Milan was the figure there, Sailor and his number two. And I can remember one who became a very notable journalist who It was always supposed to have shot down three aircraft at one burst, because they collided, but he ended up as some bigwig in the newspaper world. No, I don't think I could honestly say that I did. I mean, there were funny enough ones. I always think that, going back to it, just before we were bombed in the operations room, we had a lookout on top of the officer's mess, just to let you, he could have a visual on anything. And I asked him if he could tell me what type of aircraft for being so rude. And his reply came to me, in which he said, I don't rightly know, sir, I'm being attacked by a swarm of bees. And I think to me, if you could think of anything wittier than that, I say wittier than that, about the Battle of Britain, but it certainly stuck in my head for life, I think.
And he really was, wasn't he?
He being attacked by a swarm of bees, I don't blame him. They were immediate, whereas they had the bees, he didn't have the bombs.
Apart from Sailor Milan, who was a South African, were there many other foreign pilots on Biggin Hill?
Oh, bags on them, yes. From everywhere.
Did they seem to operate in a different way from the British pilots?
No, because, it was before the days of segregated squadrons. As far as I was concerned, at Biggin, but, I mean, you've got the Polish wing at Northolt, which were all Poles, but Biggin was a mixture of South Africans, New Zealanders, one, two Americans before the Eagle Squadrons, all shapes and sizes.
What about the contact with the public? Were you having much contact with civilians in the area?
Yes, I suppose so. Of course, largely through the Observer Corps, you know, it was a great help, because they were your outposts in every respect, you know, not only from a visual, and they would probably sometimes give you better weather reports than the Met, the meteorological side. That was always the joke, because somebody would ring up from Romney Marsh and say the weather was going to that tomorrow. I said, how do you know? Because he'd say my rheumatism was playing me up, whereas probably the Met officer got the wrong idea. They were a big factor, the Observer Corps.
But would you go for drinks in local pubs and so on and mix with civilians in that way?
Oh, Lord, every night. Yes. The White House at Braisted. Oh, it's got plaques all over the place. It was full of all the, if anybody wanted to see who fought from Biggin Hill, they could go to the White Hart. It's got an almost great thing there.
Did the civilians seem to know what was going on?
I wouldn't think so. It was really awfully strange because it sounds mad, but when I remember one occasion, I was not on. I was off for 24 hours or 12 hours, whatever it was, and I went and played golf at, can't remember, Tandridge, I think it was. And this is absolutely true. Instead of having to, if you don't know whether you're a golfer, having to sweep the worm casts away, when I was sweeping away the belting, so to speak, you know, from the what was going on up above. I mean, there was a battle going on above you while one was playing golf. I mean, it sounds crazy, but that's the way that